Welcome to the Directing Animation Livecast with Scott Weiser, who has gone from a studio of one to directing at Space Station Animation to supervising at Steamroller Animation, continuously developing over 15 feature film pitches on a quest to master the art of making deeply meaningful animated films. Today, our guest is the amazing Armand Serrano. He is somebody who is highly influential in the industry just because of his, you know, his great talent, but also the way he maneuvers in life, his religious convictions, his convictions of humanity and how he treats people and his approach to people and to projects and to anybody he works with. He has worked as a visual development artist and or art director for Blizzard, Sony, Disney, and the list goes on and on. He's just been all over the industry. Still lives in California and works on whatever project needs him. Is there anything you'd like to add to that, Arbonne?
In short, I am old. Yeah, well, thank you, Scott, for having me.
Yeah,
I'm really excited about this. I know this is a session that long been planned.
Yeah. We talked about this a year ago, didn't we?
Yeah, I almost forgot about it until you emailed me. It's like, oh, I'm glad that you emailed.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Thank you for having me, man.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you. I for years at CTNX, I've run into you and not only talk to you, but listen to you talk to other people. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of how CTNX goes, right? You sometimes are part of the conversation, sometimes just listening as you wait in line or something for something else, you know? And I remember one of my favorite memories of you is you came up and you're just saying you had a remarkable experience that day. And it was that you were drawing and just doing art, you know? And somebody's like, how are you doing that? What technique are you using? And you just raised your pencil. You said, it's called a pencil.
Oh, man, I'm glad that you remember that. When was that? What year was that?
That was about 4 years ago, I think.
Yeah. Probably the last ones before the pandemic, right?
Yeah, it was one of the last ones before the pandemic. And I just remember thinking that was remarkable because, you know, a lot of times we are looking for the newest, coolest thing, like the new technology or the new thing that's going to get us that extra edge. And you were just focusing on the fundamentals. Like, this is a pencil. This is, you know, what I use to draw. But, you know, it was also a very humble statement, I felt. You know, you're like, it's just a pencil. When really what was actually going on was years of practice, you know, years of the fundamentals, your thought process and how, you know, what goes into that and stuff. At a high level, how would you explain your thought process and your approach and how you get to the level that you're at? You can tell your story. Yeah, you can do whatever you want.
No, I'll answer that first. I mean, in terms of my thought process. It's always going back to the fundamentals, to the basics. I always tell my students, you know, until we die, we still have to be mastering our talent on perspective. You know, you have to live with that until we die as an artist, right? Mm-hmm. You gotta keep mastering anatomy. You know, you have to know what's real first before we can stylize them in animation. I think it goes, and I was one of probably a good example when I was younger as an artist coming into the industry. I thought I knew it all, you know, how I got here and I was working at the stylized projects when I first came on board in animation. And that was a while back in Manila, 30-something years ago.
Yeah.
And until I actually work with amazing artists who can do it all, you know, anatomy, perspective, you know, they can bring about amazing environments.
Yeah.
When I saw it, it's like, you know, I need to level up my skill set. And that's when I took, you know, life drawing seriously. I took I went back to, you know, honing, going back to the basics of perspectives, you know, studying Lumis and anyway, so, and also studying other people's work that I admire. But even at the end of the day, it goes back again to the very basics. And I think I was hiding in a wall of stylization.
You know,
when we stylize things, what we lack, we put it behind stylized. When we say, oh, when someone tells my work, well, you know, your line work is off, the muscle is off. Well, it's a stylized, you know, or your muscular composition or anatomy is off. No, it's stylized. So we're always making stylization as an excuse for our inability to master those fundamentals. But that's wrong, because in a trained eye, now that I am older and I'm more mature and my eyes is more trained, when I see something stylized, I can already tell if the person don't know their anatomy. I can tell if the person don't know their perspective, because that's the base. And for me, the rule is you have to know the rules before you can break them. You have to know what's real before you can stylize them.
Yeah.
So, and it's not the other way around. So yeah, that has been my, I would say, fundamental rule is if I'm in doubt, I look at what's real and go from there. You know, uh-huh. I don't just draw from memory. I mean, there's a few that has been ingrained in my mind that I've been doing over and over again. You know, foliage, vegetation. If I've been in projects when I've been doing those for long periods of time, then they get ingrained in me. It becomes second nature in me. But for some things, I still look a lot of references, you know, when I do on projects. I gather references. I still do a lot of research and reading and understanding what I research before I actually, you know, go back to drawing. Whatever I do, I have to do research, you know, authenticity of costumes, I have to make sure that the machinery is functional and authentic and believable, you know, the engineering side of things. That's what make, you know, the sets that I build functional, or at least it feels functional. It may not actually would work in real life,
but
just like the Millennium Falcon, man, that's a hamburger flying, right, with the gravity underneath. But but it's convincing, right? I mean, So it doesn't have to be fully functional, but at least it convinces the audience that this is going to work.
It feels right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm going to flash some of your art up on the screen. When I look at your art, you know, if I were casting as a director, I see, you know, it actually kind of reminds me of master painters, like the old masters and how they would paint and how they would capture light. And you don't use extremely saturated colors very often, but when you do, it's very intentional. And I can see that you can do things that are stylized. At the same time, your work feels very grounded. And I wonder if you're often hired at these different studios to bring this sense of depth, this sense of richness to the world that you're designing, mm-hmm. or just to the way light interacts with the environment, or, you know, I would see you designing things that feel very grounded, and but also you can go into the whimsical. I think it's Animal Crackers is up on the screen right now, and that's a bit more whimsical, right? And the Tree of Life,
those
paintings are very whimsical. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
And fun. Yeah. Is there anything you'd want to say to that?
Yeah. Well, thank you for mentioning about reminding you about the masters. You know, because I did. I'm still learning until now, man. So I always joke that I'm more of a faux painter. I always tell my kids I'm more like I cheat my way into painting. you know, so because I'm more of a graphite person.
Yeah.
I mean, I painted growing up. I mean, I painted more watercolor.
Yeah.
When I was growing up, and I never really used oil. For one, it was, I guess it was so messy and it's more expensive. So growing up, I just needed something. I just needed see something quick. So I would use graphite or ink. So that became my tools, my main weapon. And when I started in animation, I was a layout artist.
Interesting.
And 2D animation. Yeah, so I was a layout journeyman at Disney. And so the whole time I was just using graphite. So if you look at those old classical Pinocchio or Bambi, that's been my staple for so many years because I was in layout. So I never really dabbled into color for so many years. But I had to really drench and submerge myself into lighting because that's, we have to establish the proper lighting. And for me, I think it's a good advantage that I don't have to worry about color so much, but I'm worrying more about the values and the lighting, right? And how local values and how those things will be affected by lighting. So my focus is always on lighting. And I believe that discipline trained me. So when I needed to start doing painting, when I moved from layout to visual development, and now I needed to paint, I can establish that, I would say, I already built some muscles in my lighting and in my values. And now I have to deal with colors. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, in any work that we do, color is being carried by values, and it's not the other way around. Yes. Even if you have the best color sensibilities, but if the values is not working, then the painting is not going to look right. Most of the time, if you guys want to check this out, I did this in a few classes, in a few mentorship classes or workshops. You know, we would pick artworks online, just random artworks or photographs that we find that there's something wrong with it. And 90% of the time, I would ask them, just desaturate it, and you will find what's wrong with this. You know, when you look at an artwork and you see, are you doing something? And you would feel like, I feel like there's something wrong in this painting, but I can't put my finger on it. The first thing you have to do is desaturate it. Oh, and really? You will realize it's the light over dark over light that's not working, or it's the value distribution. Oh, they're washing out, so you cannot actually see the subject, you know. So a lot of issues in a piece fall into the category that involves values and lighting. So anyway, I forget the question, but for me, that's kind of my artistic journey. Is I went through the lighting and value route first before I dabbled heavily back into color. So when I started doing digital painting, I would always go. It took me some time to adjust, right? Because for so many years, I'm working on black and whites and grayscale values. So I had to go on a value route. Then from the values, when the values is already established, it's working for me, then I'm going to go into color, making sure that value stays intact. And it worked on me. And then I found a process that works for me having that route. There's some artists, they're really amazing, you know, that they can just go into color and they have this amazing color and value sensibilities embedded in them. And I know some of those artists are, I mean, quite, they're just amazing. I mean, so, but for me, every now and then I had to do a check and balance with my values just to make sure that it's working. So again, you know, that's just my discipline and that's how I'm wired.
I think it's awesome. I was often told throughout school and then into professional, all my art that I did on the side, because I'm primarily an animator, I was told that I had a strong color sensibility. And so I went into some classes to learn more about color, to kind of strengthen that. Even though I was told I was strong at it, I was like, if I'm strong at it, I should probably keep improving it, right? And that was what they kept telling me. Value is the key. And so you should do a lot of grayscale stuff. So for my first books that I doubles feature film pitches, my illustrations were fully black and white. Yeah. And only half the people noticed it wasn't even in color, you know, which was kind of cool. Because my goal was like to really push my abilities to use values. And I didn't do color until my third book/ feature film pitch. Yeah. And I think it made a difference. For sure.
Yeah. You know, those black and whites, splash any kind of color, even the wildest colors that you could find, even unnatural colors, just splash any kind of color. As long as the values is right, it will hold up.
Yeah.
But if the value is not right, whatever color you use, it's not going to work.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. And I know it does take a little bit of tweaking. Like you have to then push and pull the colors. You don't want to just like put a wash on there and that's all you've got. But, you're already more than halfway there with values. It's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Well, great. I love hearing about that. Do you have any tricks like that? You know, you say if there's something wrong with the picture, if you desaturate it, that's going to help you see what's wrong. Do you have any tricks like that for composition?
Well, composition, and oh my gosh, you opened a can of worm here for me.
That's
because
okay.
I have a different philosophy, and whenever I say composition, for me, composition involves four different things, and values. So, you know, every time, sometimes we, again, this is just me talking. I'm not criticizing other people's understanding of the word composition. When I say composition, it always involves four things. Number one is values. So that's the lighting, right? Oh, yeah. The black, you know. Then you have color,
okay.
And you have perspective, and you have staging. And sometimes, most of the time, we associate composition with just staging. And I've noticed that sometimes a person would tell me, "Oh, is my composition correct?" And I'm thinking, which part of composition? Because yeah. You're just viewing the word composition, and some people are separating composition and staging. What's so different? Does it mean that staging is not composition? You know, so it's confusing, right? But if you really think about it, composition is the word. That's the main tool. It's the it's the Swiss knife that you can use for so many things. That is the composition. You don't have composition plus this. You can do composition plus sound, because sound is not part of it, because that's a different sensibility. Anything visual is just one word, composition. Just like, let me give you an example. Chemistry, right?
Yeah.
We use the word composition in chemistry. If you say water, that's H2O. That's the composition. So you have two hydrogen molecules of hydrogen,
oxygen.
And one oxygen, right? So that's the composition. You get two hydrogens. Maybe you have two components of a staging and one component of perspective. You know, so that composed water. In your let's say staging, you took out one hydrogen. Now you're telling a different story. That's an HO. That's a totally different chemical in the material. The same thing in music. When we use the word composition, you don't say composition and cello. No, it's just that's part of the composition. It's, you know, that sound goes into the composition. So for me, when you say composition, it's values, it's the black and white, it's the color, it's the perspective. And because perspective relates to camera, you know, and lenses. And a lot of people don't know that. Why do we have 2-point perspective? Why do we have 3-point perspective to 4-point perspective? Well, a 1-point perspective is a long lens. 2-point perspective is that's our regular lens, you know, from any 35 to 55 millimeter. Then then if you do a 3-point, 4-point perspective, that's a wide angle lens. And people, sometimes when they compose things or they will stage them, they don't even know why they're doing, you know, oh, just look cool. No, that's the lensing of the camera. That's why we're applying it into the perspective form.
Okay.
So that's why perspective is a big part of your composition. Do you want to do a down shot, up shot, wide angle shot? And lastly, staging is how you place things in the shot.
Okay.
So anyway, I'm yeah. So I forgot the question, but that is my philosophy.
Your trick for figuring out what's wrong with the composition. So you have the trick of like desaturating.
Yeah. So the first line of the first testing, if I have a dial, so in Photoshop, the first thing I do is actually, the first question I ask is, what is the story being told here?
Uh-huh.
What is the concept? And, you know, a lot of times, artists are making concept, they call concept art without any concept at all. Oh, just because it looks cool. You know, I want to put a big castle and a stick man at the bottom. That's it, you know, because it looks great. But not all scenes in the movie are like that. There are probably like 5 scenes in a movie that will require a big castle and a stick man. a Lawrence of Arabia shot, and everybody wants to do that. And for them, oh, that is a great composition. But most of the time, in an actual, you know, where the rubber meets the road, in an actual production, I would say, you know, half of the time, you know, it's just a medium shot, or it's just a very boring, sad moment of a boy lost his mom and he's crying in the bedroom. how can you compose a sad moment for a kid inside a boring bedroom? That's where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah.
Now, the person who's thinking about a castle in a stick man is like, I don't know. I've been trained that this is the best composition. No, you don't do that. So,
can you imagine you do that to the little boy on the bed? They're like, what's going on in that little person?
Yeah, you know, this big pillow and small kid. So what I'm saying here is visual storytelling, there are rules. There are things measurable. And that's why I started. I was so passionate about it when I discovered it. I mean, I learned it on my own. I went to the books. I read books about composition and visual storytelling. I was trained, you know, in animation to do those things, you know, to do storytelling. But at some point, I had to hone, you know, put them in an anchor into what's the basic, because there's so many terminologies that we are trained or we've been taught through the years, you know, about there's so many things that you can hear, like, oh, you know, create an emotion, create the mood. And I just realized if I have only four things to master, I will master those four things: staging, color, lighting, which is the values, and perspective. If I master those four, I'll be able to control mood. I'll be able to control emotion. I'll be able to control whatever it is that's being required, you know, by the story. And by that, a good concept artist, because there's a lot of concept art out there that they're more conceptless concept art.
Yeah.
They have no concept at all. They just
there's no concept. I love that.
They're just piggyback riding on another person's visual storytelling that they found on ArtStation without them even knowing what the intent of that artwork was. So imagine that, you know, artists, it's so sad. Artists are piggyback riding on another person's visual storytelling. And that person that they're looking at also piggyback riding on somebody else's artwork that he saw online. And it goes along the way. So there's a disconnect. But for them, why are you using reds? Why are you using the saturation? Why are you using that kind of lighting? Why did you pick that perspective? Why did you make it an upshot? Why did you make it a downshot? Are you considering the emotion that will impact the audience by making those, you know, those decisions? So every decision that we make on any of those four will affect the visual storytelling. So a good visual storyteller, in terms of using composition, just like a composer in music, is he knows when to put a minor or a major seven in their notes that will impact the audience. So every music has a story, and it will drive you happy, or it will drive you sad. It will encourage you. I did this to my class a lot. You know, I have them listen to Darth Vader's Death March, you know, which we all know, right, from Empire Strikes Back. And it's a really ominous, you know, it's a minor, you know, music. Then someone played it on a major, just one note change, and it sounded like a graduation march. You know, it's like really happy, joyful. Yeah, you know, I finished my school, that kind of feel. And that proves the point that just one note changes the story. Same thing in our composition. If you know what you're doing, or it will determine also if you know what you're doing or you don't know what you're doing. So there's a lot of visual storytellers that don't know what they're doing because they're just piggyback riding on somebody else's artwork, as opposed to knowing how to control the minds of the audience, the perception of the audience, which is our ultimate goal as an artist, is to control your audience because you're telling a story to them.
Interesting.
By making a composition that would work for the audience. When we compose things, it's not for us. We know the story. We're the storyteller. It's for the audience. It's for the audience. It's nothing about me. It's about them, right? So that's why you have to know the audience. It's like telling a joke. If you don't tell the joke right, you know, the components, the timing, you know, when to intonate, And if you tell the story and your audience didn't laugh, there's a breakdown somewhere. Same thing with our visual storytelling. If I want to make my audience love with my one piece painting, then there has to be a breakdown. And the breakdown is somewhere there. It could be the perspective, it could be, you know, the values, it could be color, or it could be the staging. So
yeah.
So yeah, I mean there's a lot of things to learn, but actually you can consolidate things into those four, and once you master the four, you can tell any story that you want through the pieces of art that you make.
Yeah. Let me give you a bit more background on that question too, if we want to go any deeper on it. Right now I am re-storyboarding an animatic for one of my feature films, and it almost almost works. It almost did well with the audience that I'm pitching it to, and I almost got the funding. It's just off, right? And actually, the moment I saw it failing, I could see what was wrong with it, right? So I'm fixing it. But one thing I'm doing to like push my abilities as a storyboard artist is I'm taking Miyazaki's storyboards and I am drawing them. And I'm studying them, and I'm looking at like how he progresses from one shot to another.
Yeah.
And I mean, you talk about doing something that's really humbling. Like I look at that, I just see this master at work, right? I'm like, how did he think about that? How did he?
Yeah.
And I'm getting it more over the years as I've done this exercise. It's really opened my mind. But still, even so, once I do a composition of my own, I'm always wondering how to push it. So my question for you, just one more on composition, is when you get a storyboard that they say do a concept piece of this storyboard.
Yeah.
What do you do to push that? Is it those four elements that you'll go into and you just kind of go down?
So in visual storytelling, you know, as an art director, we do color keying, right? There's, you know, key moments, and you can see the progression of the color, and you know, with the set rules that we would put on color, and you can also create lighting key. So think about this: if you can graph them, you know, so you have a graph, right? X and Y, you know, so scene numbers and intensity, you know, the intensity of that emotion. I'm just going to keep it, you know, simple: intensity and scene numbers.
Okay.
So let's say I want to bring my audience to a wild roller coaster ride. You know, James Bond is so good with that. You know, when you watch James Bond, you have a something, they are in the middle of an action, right? As soon as you sat on the theater, boom, you know, you're right in the middle of this climax from a previous mission.
Yeah.
Then it would ease you into the movie. If you're going to graph that, as soon as you sit right on the first shot, the intensity is so high, like boom, it's right high up. Then it's going to graph down, the emotion goes down, then gradually bring you up to the new story. How can you control that is through composition. You can graph everything. So it means people are only, you know, or we're so limiting when we only do, can you color key? Yeah, I can color key. Can you do some lighting key? Of course, we can do lighting key. You can also do camera key, wherein, you know, and this is how I see it. So when you key the camera, you can start with horizontals, right? So everything has to be, or even camera move, control camera moves. So don't do a lot of downshot, upshots, you know, unless they're establishing. So do them, again, I'm making this example here.
Yeah.
Maybe at the start of your film, everything is just static. Then you start adding camera moves. Then there's a little bit of fight here. So there's some camera tilting. So when you graph it, it will start, then say, poop, poop, poop. Then it goes back again. Then you're testing the audience and give them a little bit of excitement just to engage them on their seat. Using only thinking, this is just camera that you're thinking about, the movement of your camera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then there's a fight scene. Then you start doing, you know, and you're jarring the minds of the audience where you left off here on the left side, you pick it up on the right side. So these are some rules in camera that you're actually jarring your audience for a purpose. So it's very intentional because you don't want them to engage. You want to jar their mind, you know, their senses. Then you bring them back into a settling. So you control them. So you get the graph doing this, boom, 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 boom. And then suddenly you settle them again. You can key anything. You can key your perspective. You can graph your perspective with regards to, let's say, extreme shots, you can graph them because all those things can be graphed. So in your movie, in your timeline, you have, let's say you have so many graphs, you will see that, oh, you know what, maybe I will tone down my camera moves here, but actually I want to accentuate the use of this, of saturation on this part. So from your graphs, you see the entire movie, you know. So again, that's how I, because I was doing a lot of workbooking in 2D animation for features before at Disney. So those things I learned from my supervisor. Actually, I was working under Hans Bakker and Bob Walker.
Yeah.
The late Bob Walker, the director of Brother Bear. He was, that guy is the one who really, you know, kind of spent time and gave me some mentorship when I was working at Disney under him in Florida. And seeing how Hans will give me some instructions, you know, in terms of that visual storytelling. So both guys, you know, that has been my, I think for me, that's the best visual storytelling school I could ever have. And after that, I felt like, okay, now I'm prepared to do more of this. And I understood a lot of things. Until now, I'm still learning, but I found that there's a lot of those storytelling cues that I got from both of them that until now I still, you know, use. And we did a lot of, not a lot, but a few workshops at Disney in terms of visual storytelling that some of those I kind of incorporate in my process. Some of them, you know, this doesn't work for me. So putting them all together in my Armand pot, the one that I could comprehend in my head. And it works all the time for me, you know. And a few moments it doesn't work, then that's the time. Okay, now I have to use my own emotion in this one, my artistic sensibilities. You know, how do I feel? Honestly, how do I feel in this shot? If I don't feel the intended emotion, then I'll change it. You know, I'll try to find it. But for the most part, I learned how to measure things again using. Yeah, those four elements.
Yeah.
I don't know if I answered the question. I totally forgot.
I think you did.
I
think you did.
I totally forgot.
It was really cool. I was really cool to listen to. It's actually very interesting. The thing you're discussing is something that it seems like everybody in the animation team needs to know. You need to understand this stuff, you know. When you're animating, you need to understand like this is the size of emotion and action that I'm going to use in this shot. And if it's a very quiet moment, you're not going to be moving all over the place, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So you've got to choose that intensity, yeah.
Now I remember the question. Yeah, so there's, the way I teach it is, so there's, the rules that apply in a static image is the same rule that apply in moving images. Mm-hmm. So moving images, meaning it's a sequence of events. It's for storyboarding, for workbooking, for layout. So I'm, and that was my expertise before I went into visual development. I'm so, you know, blessed to know and being trained in layout. So even in 3D layout, I can see it. You know, I'm very in tune to, because I did workbook, so I can follow the continuity, you know, and those applications in moving images is so crucial because one mistake could disengage the audience in a moving image. So you have to make your, the goal is always to keep your audience engaged. So, and again, that's why it's so important. I love when I was working, you know, we were all working under John Lasseter. He would always tell us, you know, who's your audience? Who's your audience? Is it the four quadrant? You know, so what
yeah,
because knowing the audience, so you know how to tell the story. So that is very crucial. That's so important. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. So we chatted a little bit before this about AI, and it's that buzzword. You know, the moment you say it, the feelings, emotions just kind of go in all these directions, right?
Yeah.
Let me
get my water to drink first.
Well, I actually don't think we should talk. We both agree that there are certain ethical issues that need to be in play. There's always the reality that it's here to stay. We got to just kind of reconcile with it, see what we're going to do with it. At the same time, as I was listening to you, I think that one of the negative consequences of AI is it seems like a lot of students are losing their drive to learn the fundamentals. Mm-hmm. What kind of case, because, and I know that you're the kind of guy that, you know, you're one of the first artists I saw using AI and very excited about it, right? And I know you've stopped because of ethical issues, mm-hmm. but at least temporarily until those yeah. get sorted out. But so you're not threatened by it. And at the same time, mm-hmm. you still practice the fundamentals. So what's your case for that?
Yeah, let me consolidate my mind here a bit. So, yeah, when it came, I mean, I'm always fascinated with new technologies. You know, when I remember when VR came along, a good friend of mine, Goro, he was the first one to be using the virtual reality Oculus.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Yeah, and he was the one who actually got me into it. He said, try it out and this, and I saw him did it. And so I tried it, and I was like, wow, you know, this is not a toy. I remember when I was at Disney, we have this mocap, you know, place. Then, and together in that same room, we have, I think, four or three stations for VR, and nobody's using those. So a good friend of mine and myself, we started playing with it. And immediately, you know, we saw apps that, like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
You know, if we can extract this file inside Oculus and bring it out, right? And we found that we can do that. So anyway, I have to try technology and the new technology and see for myself which has a potential to be used. I'm always thinking, how can I use this in production? How can I be more efficient if I use this in production? So that's always my mentality in things. It's always against the production, because that's what I do. So I tried different things, and I used different, I remember using three different 3D apps, from Maya to a SketchUp, then now with VR. I mean, I'm trying to find a way for my own that will speed up my process. That's always my goal.
Yeah.
Then AI came to be in, and at first I was ignoring it. you know, I was telling you earlier before this show, we were just having a chat about Napster. I will confess, when Napster, I don't know, for you guys young, ask your parents if you guys don't know what Napster
is. Oh, I remember
what
Napster is. But and I did use,
you
know, it, sadly.
If you remember it, you might be a little bit older. You know, you're maybe a millennial.
Yeah.
So anyway, when Napster came along, I mean, nobody can make out of it. It's like, what is this? You know, this is file sharing. It's amazing. I jumped into it big time. And it's like, oh, all right. You know, and, you know, and I'm always about ethics. And, you know, sometimes when there's a new technology, it's so exciting that we jump into it. And at some point, oh, this is unethical because there's some copyright issues and stuff. So once it happened, actually it died on its own because of those copyright infringement problems. So I stopped using it. But eventually at the back of my mind, it's going to amount to something. And fast forward, that has been, I believe, that has been the precursor to our music streaming that we know of, right?
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
Right?
Right.
You know, this, it's AI. And AI comes in different forms. And I'm sure you guys have been, probably a lot of, you know, viewers here using ChatGPTs and probably using other forms of AI. I tried an AI app to consolidate my calendar. And it's amazing because I was trying to budget my time within a week, you know, family time, this. And so I tried it, and there are increments of 5 minutes, you know, and 15 minutes. And I'm having a tough time consolidating everything. So I tried it on an AI. It's like, whoa, it's amazing. It actually built it for me. So, but I'm the one controlling it. I don't want the AI control me, because when it build it, there's still some, okay, this won't work. I have to adjust it. So there's still some fine tuning. So the way I see it is, any kind of technological advancement, it's like a diving board, springboard. Let's say if number one is step one, right? And we want to go to number 10, which is the goal. You know, that's the end product, whether it's an artwork or music or whatever it is. So when we were drawing everything traditionally, we do it from one 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? So that's the proper way. Then Cintiq comes, Photoshop comes. It springboarded us from 1 to, whoa, I can go to 3 right away, or 4, right? You know, I don't have to mess around with paint and mix paint anymore. I can just go straight to it. So that springboarded me from number 1 to, I would say, number 3. Then VR came along. It springboarded me from number 1 to number 5. But I still have a long ways to go. It's not done yet.
Yeah.
Then I'm all for ethics and everything, all those use. That's why I stopped using, I paused on using AI for the meantime until it gets regulated. When I was using it before, when it first came out, I started using it. It springboarded me from 1 to, let's say, number 6. But it's not the end product. It still looks so bad. You know, but it springboarded me. It gave me some foundational elements, just like everybody who's photo bashing stuff. And they thought, okay, so this is my base painting. Then I will move forward, you know. So I found AI to springboard me a little bit farther than if I use, let's say, a photo bash. But I still have a long ways to go afterwards. So that's the human component.
I love
also,
that.
Also, to identify that I springboarded from 1 to 5, it takes a human eye to make that judgment that I went from 1 to 5. That's a human decision. It's not, nobody told me about it. That's just my innate judgment or assessment that, I went from this to this, but I still have a long ways to go. And I remember when I was dabbling with it early on, the ones that I posted, those were just fun. Okay, this is what I prompted, this is what I got, cool. But if I use it, let's say I did some testings on the side during those times, if I'm going to use it, I still have there was one time I actually did a painting using that as a base, but there's an original intent on the painting. You can get your emotion from an AI. It's a hit and miss. It's a trial and error.
Yeah.
It's always just the accidental things. I remember doing a painting and the end product, when I look back, it's like, even look like the AI that I started the base from.
Yeah.
It's so different.
Yeah.
But it helped my visualization. It helped me jump a little bit farther, but I was able to finish it on less time than what I allotted for it.
Yeah.
Now, having said all that, I pressed the pause button until, at least on the image type of AIs, you know, that we use. And viewers, probably you guys know what those things are, what those applications are, until it's regulated.
Yeah.
But the thing though for me, and it's just my own conviction, you know, I'm not telling the audience you have to do this, you have to use it. If it goes against your conviction, personal conviction, then don't use it.
Yeah.
And my personal conviction is me as a professional, me as a teacher, me as a I want to consider myself as an innovator because I'm always fascinated with new things. Don't be afraid to try new things. I'm thinking if Leonardo da Vinci is living in our time, he may not do it publicly, but he will be tinkering with it on his own. Especially now, you know, with Firefly that came, Adobe just released Firefly. By the way, guys, you guys may not know it, but you know the content aware button in your Photoshop, that's an AI that we had in our Photoshop for a long period of time. You just don't know it, but that small button is an AI. I use it a lot, you know, taking out some dirt or some, you know, healing brush. There's a bit of AI-ness into it too.
Yeah.
So
autofilling text messages, like it's all over. We've actually been using AI for a long time.
We've been using it. It's just in a more significant way.
Yeah.
It's interesting because, go ahead.
Oh, yeah.
I said so much about it.
Yeah. I actually haven't shared this publicly. So I did one of the first experiences, and I haven't used it for months. And my personal reason for not using it is I actually felt that I needed to grow a lot as an artist first.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't ready for it, and I didn't feel like the tools were quite ready for me to use them either.
Yeah.
And but the first experiment I did, I was struggling to design a certain character. I went and did some prompts to kind of inspire the character. The interesting thing is I took those prompts with me on the way to Lightbox Expo last year, and I was drawing them. And none of the prompts inspired the character, but they inspired a side character who's related to this character, right? So the main character actually still came several steps after, but it inspired another character, and it still looks completely different than what the AI gave me, but it was a fun experiment, right? I love one thing you said, and it actually answers the other question I was going to ask. You said that I don't want the AI to control me. I want me to control the AI. And I think that that is at the core of any of the technological issues we're dealing with right now. You know, unintentionally, we've let social media control us. We're letting an algorithm control the kind of content we post. We're letting, we're letting constant scrolling consume our time. We've become addicted to likes and just, and being distracted rather than dealing with our own problems. So I think that that's really the key. Is, and I'm trying to do this, I have all these diagrams that I've written of how I'm going to use AI in the future once I'm ready for it. And it is always sandwiching human things in there. Like, oh, if AI saves me an hour of time, can I go have a real human interaction that actually makes a difference in someone's life? You know, that also inspires the story of the film. You know, how can I sandwich these human experiences in there so that suddenly the AI is, getting you from 1 to 6, but then it's helping you. So once you got to 6, it's a lot easier for you to get to 30, you know, or wherever you need to go.
And that's the use, you know. It's interesting, you know, I was telling you earlier before the show, I just came back from Manila. And right before I left, me and another artist here from the U.S. also, we were invited in this big government creative launch, and hundreds of creatives from the country were present. It's a government, you know, the president initiated it. And so it's a big creative event, a lot of creative leaders. So we were sitting there, you know, I think we're the only ones coming from animation. And we just so happened we were in Manila at that time. He's one of our speakers and myself. Since we were there, they invited us to sit down on a panel. And I said, oh, sure, you know, we'll go. And so we were sitting in the panel and I asked them, so what the topic? I didn't even know what the topic was. And they showed me the topic, you know. It's about human creativity with the age of AI. And I said, wait, it's about AI. And we were already in stage, right? So found out everyone who's speaking, you know, some of them from, you know, I think some from Singapore and from, they openly use AI. They embrace, and it was so weird, you know, here in the US, we're so afraid to talk about it. You know, even to talk about it, you're going to have pushback.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like you're an outcast if you talk about AI, even, you know, just a slight, and that's so bad because we're shutting down conversation. We have to have, a more intelligent and educated conversations about it. Yeah. Not because we talk about it doesn't mean that I fully agree with it. We just needed to talk about it with no contempt, with no, you know, with you know, nothing. You know, we no preconceived ideas. When we were there, it's like the whole creative industry, they embrace it. I just found out everyone was speaking, oh yeah, we incorporated it in our education, you know. So some of them is starting to use it, I guess, with the kids, you know. It means I don't know what they're talking about, if they're applications or what, but I hope they're not implanting AI.
And letting it control the human.
It's in the system. So I said, right on. I mean, this is interesting. So I was listening to all of them and trying to get, that makes sense. You know, you advertising, they embrace AI there, in Asia.
Yeah.
And in my mind, we're going to be left behind here in the Western world if this, you know, if they're in Asia, you know, using this, so they are jumping way ahead of us, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, there might be some ethical issues or what. I'm not even dabbling into that. Because for me, as my personal conviction, if there's some ethical issues, then I won't use it on my own, you know, just for me. But the question that they ask us is mainly, what's the human component? What's the human creative component in an age of AI?
Yeah.
And, you know, they have some profound answers, and some of them I can understand because some of them involves like financial stuff and money stuff, and it just, you know, flew over my head. But
yeah,
my answer was, it would, you know, in the art world, in the artistic side, I said there is still the human component that you cannot take away, because we're still be the one. An AI, there's no AI that will make a judgment over an AI. It's still a human person. It takes a creative human being to make a judgment that will say that works and that doesn't work.
Yeah.
And for that person to make the judgment, and this is what I share with them, is you have to go back to the books. You still have to know your anatomy. You still have go to back your to the basics, lighting, yeah. your color, yeah. you know, to, yeah. for you to, I said, yeah, there's a lot of happy accidents on AI, just like in any other.
And that's
tool
why we
that
like
we
it,
use.
Actually. But, that's why it's inspiring.
Yeah. yeah. But the problem is, you know, a person who's lazy and not, you know, who's not practicing or not building their muscles on the fundamentals, they wouldn't even know that the happy accident, there's happiness in those accidents. They wouldn't even know that accidents are happening, because they can't even tell which one is happy and which one is not happy. Yeah. Right? So the that's the problem. It's, you know, you're, yeah, okay, let's just, it's laziness. I think that's the, I believe that's the problem with that. With social media, you know, you mentioned that, you know, I'm just going to go for the likes. And I remember there was one time there was one person told me, hey, you should hire this guy. He has 1 million likes. And I said, I don't care about the likes. Not because 1 million people who are not artists liking this person's artwork will make me hire that person. I'll be the one to judge that, the hiring process for the person.
Yeah.
So like is not, and I just tell to your audience that having so many likes in your social media doesn't make you a better artist.
No, you brought you're up just Da Vinci. Da Vinci for 16 yeah. years was there's actually a YouTube video called This Guy mm-hmm. Was a Loser. Da Vinci Was a Loser. Because for 16 years, yeah. he was considered in the art world a loser, but then he's now considered one of the most revolutionary guys. And it's because he just kept working on the fundamentals. Mm-hmm. He kept working on his passion. And after a while, people started realizing what he was doing, you know?
Yeah. And, yeah. So if you want to, yeah. if you don't want to be liked on social media, go ahead. And that's as far as you would go. You know, people would do that. They would ask me, hey, how can I get to this? You know? And I said, people told me not to compare myself to any other work. And I said, no, you have to compare your work to somebody else in order for you to get to Disney.
Yeah.
You know, that's always the question when I talk to students. How can I go to Disney? How can I work for Disney? I said, do you have Art of Books from Disney? I said, and they said, no, you have to start buying Art of Books of Disney. Really? Why? Because that is, you're so fortunate that you have access to the standard of what Disney artists are doing. In my time, I have to go to the library to make Xerox copies of those. You guys can just access them online. Look for someone who's working for Disney, then compare your artwork to that person's work, right? So it's then you have to do your part, you know, and that's the point I'm making is then train yourself, you know, don't be lazy. Don't just rely on, I want to get so a million likes on my work. Then you're not aiming for Disney. You're aiming to be popular on social media. Then just, I don't know, just go dancing with the stars, I guess. If you want to make
yourself
want
to be popular.
Popular, you know. So, but if yeah. you want to go for Disney, what you need to do is look at the artworks of people who are working for Disney. Then that's your standard, you know. Go back to the basics and attain that is the mark. If you think that your artwork is really close now to that person's artwork, then send it to Disney. Send it to DreamWorks. Send it to Skydance. Or if you think that you're at par with the quality of the person you're looking at, then send it to Disney. Or yeah. if you think that your work is now better than that person, then by all means, send it to Disney.
Yeah. And but if you need instruction on that. So, sorry.
Oh, no. Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. if you're just going for likes, then it's so sad. You can only, that's the level. If your goal is comparing yourself to the best person in your class, then that's as far as you would go. Then you would be the best person in your class, but it's not going to bring you to Disney. If you compare your artwork to your teacher, then your goal is the class. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Whoever you put as a comparison to, that's only as far as you would go. So if you, I'm not undermining teachers, I'm a teacher myself, but if you're comparing, if your teacher, if your high school teacher, art teacher is, you just want to be like him, then compare your artwork to his work. But if you want to attain the Disney standard, then go for that goal. It has nothing to do with likes or dislikes on social media. And
or how many followers
So the followers makes us lazy.
Yes.
And, you know, so like go back to the gym, you know, just work out those design muscles every day, you know, until you muscled enough to go to Disney or DreamWorks or Skydance, you know, or Sony.
Yeah, I have a similar experience where I directed at a YouTube studio with this YouTube celebrity already had the capacity to get us likes, right? So my first 5 episodes I directed, we got over 50 million views. And, you know, I thought that would feel fulfilling, and it didn't. I think actually this book, Cirque de Solitude, there was a young woman who read it, and she said it described the woman she wanted to be, the woman she was becoming. And to me, that was really meaningful. You know, that one review was worth more than 50 million views. So that's what we're going for. We're going for the soul of the work. We're going for the meaning. We're going for, you know, things that move people, not just things that are flashy that get you a bunch of likes. And I love those points. We've gone a little bit long because it's been such a stimulating conversation, but I don't want to miss it. I don't want to miss the Get Wiser moment that we always ask a deep question. I usually talk about meaning and how to get the most meaning into a film. But, you know, one thing that's interesting about you, Armand, is that you are very Christian and you're very open about it. And a lot of people in our industry sometimes feel like they need to hide their beliefs. Mm-hmm. I would like to know how your beliefs enhance your art and how your art enhances your belief.
Yeah, I mean, thanks for asking that question. So, you know, I don't have a separation of church and state, you know, in my belief. You know, because sometimes we compartmentalize, right? You know, I'm a Christian, but I don't want to be out as a Christian, you know, in animation, because I felt like, you know, some people would tell me, if I like, if I go out as a Christian, that's the end of my career.
Yeah.
But actually, it's not. I think, you know, I do believe that my faith played a big part, if not the most major part, in my career choices. Mm-hmm. I do believe in God, like what you said. I do believe in God. And every time people would ask me, so how can you get out of your creative rut? You know, so I said, number one, I always joke about it. You know, number one, I think about my bills. You know, so, but I mean, seriously, I mean, I would just say, I just take time. I would pause and I pray, you know, because I profess a Christian, so I pray to my Creator, right? So if we believe that there is a Creator, which I do believe that God is my Creator, and He's the ultimate artisan, you know, He created everything, the heavens and the earth, and the heavens and the earth declares the glory of God. That is the person I'm going to ask. I'm not going to ask my person beside me. I'm not going to ask, you know, that guy, this guy, that guy. You know, I go back to the, if there is a fundamental, I'm going to go back to the foundation of everything, which is God. So 100%, guys, never, 100%, never fail. You know, in no time, I'm back on my feet.
Yeah.
You know, in the creative juices, you know,
are flowing.
Back.
Yeah.
Yeah. So honestly, I mean, no kidding, no pride or anything. I would say that I never really I never really got into a creative rut at all. In the past years of my life, I'm looking back. I do get tired. And if you get tired, guys, sometimes we mistake tiredness as, oh, I'm in a creative rut. No, you're tired. Just rest. I don't know, play video games. And then go back to work or
find,
you know,
some way to rejuvenate.
I mean, just because a lot of us are you know, so a lot of us are just tired, and the reason that we're so tired, you know, as a person on a Monday, how are you? Oh, I'm tired. It's just a Monday, guys. Monday, but are you tired already? Yeah, so I don't want to hang out with you because you're so tired. Don't be I mean, so excited, you know, it's a Monday, you know, it's the start of the week. And I'm looking back, I never felt like I was in a creative rut during this time. I can't think of the last time, honestly, that I was in a creative rut. And again, that's a testament, I believe, in my relationship with my God. And at the same time, too, I think that, you know, the values that I put in my work, my God requires me to have excellence in what I do. Yesterday, we were just having a study online, and I was sharing that to the artist that beauty comes... The reason why we have beauty in our work is because of excellence. Mm-hmm. You know, not perfection. Perfection is so different from excellence. A lot of people are trying to aim for perfection. Aim for perfection, but you will always get excellence. And in excellence comes beauty. But mediocrity, the ones that we give, you know, every time we say, oh, that's good enough. Every time we say that, that's come from survival. And I think most artists are in a survival mode as opposed to in an excellence mode. Huh. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So, and the reason why we're in a survival mode, and there's so many factors, you know, could be financial, could be stress, could be, I think the stress part, if I talk to people, whenever I talk to them, they're just overcommitting themselves, or they're just putting an unexpected or an unattainable goal in front of them. Oh yeah, I want to do this. Oh, I can do everything. No, just be realistic of what you can do within a day. We can only do so much within a day. And that, and how did I learn that? I just learned that from the values because of my faith. So my faith requires me for excellence because I know that if God is living inside of me, I'll bring out excellence in every stroke that I do. It's anointed. In everything that I do, there's a divine influence on it. So if I have if there's an Armand here, which is, you know, that believes in God, and the previous Armand here that doesn't believe in God, we may do the same stroke, but this stroke will go longer than that old stroke that I would do because I believe that there's a spirit, you know, living inside of me. So, So I will never, I never settle for just good enough. And I always translate that to my students. You know, if it's a good enough, we will push you a little bit more. I mean, good enough doesn't cut it. You know, in the teams that I lead in production, there's some people, you know, that cannot, you know, I'll give them enough opportunities to show excellence. And I coach them. It's not like I'm giving them, you know, I always help my team as much as I could. And if I see that people are just going for mediocrity, then that doesn't have any space in my team. So I just have to find another person for that team because I always require excellence because that's what I do. And excellence breeds excellence in other people. And when there's excellence, it will breed beauty in everything that we do. Now, some stuff that we're seeing are so it's so much mediocrity in art that we see because most people are just in a survival mode. For me, I think I'm not saying I don't struggle, but I struggle in my life, but I always pass the struggle part into going back to excellence because I know, because it's all about my faith, that what I believe in. So,
yeah, you're not going to be in a rut.
So I don't know if that answers the question.
It does. You're not going to be in a rut if you have enthusiasm, right? And the word enthusiasm means God is in you, right? And I think that's necessary as an artist. It's necessary for you to get, I mean, whatever, the highest possible power you believe in, you know, get more of that. And if that's not working, then get a higher power, you know?
And if it doesn't show in my life, then it doesn't show. But I think for the most part,
it shows.
God haven't failed me yet. Since,
yeah, me either.
Well, not actually. I take it back. God haven't failed me. I don't say yet because I'm not looking forward to the time that he would. I knew for a fact that he wouldn't. So I do believe until I die, until I retire, or even beyond my retirement, I'm still going to be doing what I love to do as he allows me to. And I'm willing to keep going, you know, as long as I'm, you know, able. But I know that I wouldn't rely on my own strength. I always rely on his strength, and that what kept me going, and that what make me so passionate in everything that I do.
And at the same
time, what's amazing is I do have a family, guys. You know, I do have family obligations, and I use my family I spend time with my family. That's my priority. I don't care about studios. I don't care about my job. If it's my priority, my, you know, if it's time with my family, that goes priority over everything. My time with God, my time with my family, then my time with studios. So my advice for you guys is don't make the studio as your identity nor your destination. The studio that you guys in, that those are just vehicles, you know, you're in a journey.
Yeah, and layoffs happen and all sorts of things happen. I actually, I had a friend that we had a conversation yesterday, and it was a cool conversation because, you know, he asked me if my religion and my beliefs have impacted my career in a negative way. And I said, yes. Like, I know there are jobs and different people who didn't want to work with me who, you know, because of that. But that was a good thing. Because it weeded out the kind of people I want to work with. I want to work with people who are open, and they don't have to have the same belief system as me, obviously. It's just it's a matter of respect and openness to learning and to exploring together that honestly it has made my career better. Infinitely better.
Yeah.
So I love everything you're saying. I think that answered the question really well. And
I forgot what I'm gonna say. I mean, it just slipped my mind. So anyway, that's my age coming in. So,
yes, no worries.
Yeah
we're about to wrap. Thanks a bunch for coming on the show. It's been wonderful, wonderful discussion. I learned a ton. Until next time, I hope we all get a little wiser. Oh, didn't play. This is when my end video plays. You can tell this is live. This is not pre-recorded.
Thank you for watching the Directing Animation Livecast, hosted by Scott Weiser, audio version edited by Kira Horowitz, copyright Scott Weiser LLC 2023. Don't forget to subscribe on YouTube and ring that notification bell.